And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, but before we get to today's theme, I want to talk about the poll up on my website. I asked last week a simple yes-no question. Will you be looking for a new job in 2012? The answers were these. Of the people taking the poll, 23% said yes, they will be looking for a new job. 77% of the people taking the poll said no. We have a new poll up on the website, brainstormingonline.com. Go there today, and I ask another very simple question. Who had a greater influence on U.S. history, Martin Luther King or Cesar Chavez? Cast your vote up there, and you can see the interim results when you take the poll. I will announce the overall results on next Thursday's show. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is potpourri. Each of my guests has an interesting topic, no two of which are related. My next guest is the assistant managing editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. We'll talk about the rise of the Glock handgun from his book titled Glock. And if you want to call in and ask a question or join the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Paul Barrett is the assistant managing editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, and he writes for the Sunday New York Times Book Review. He's appeared on NBC's Today Show, CNN, and NPR. Paul's the author of three books. His latest book is titled Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. He lives in New York with his wife and their dachshund, Bo. Welcome to the show, Paul. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, thank you for being our guest. Love to have subject matter experts such as yourself on the show. And this is really a wedge issue in the United States because we're talking
Absolutely.
About guns, and it is one of the most emotional issues that we Americans face, and particularly this month because January marks the one-year anniversary of the shooting of Senator Gabriella Giffords and others in Tucson, Arizona. The gun that was used to perpetrate the crime was the Glock. And as I said,
Correct.
Guns are definitely a wedge issue here. Why did you decide to write about the Glock, a firearm that evokes really such emotions in a controversial arena?
Yeah. Well, guns are an integral part of American society, for better or for worse. The imagery of firearms is bound up with our culture. Think of the Minuteman in the Revolutionary War shooting at the British Redcoats, the cowboy in the American West in the 19th century, the film noir detective of the 30s, the GI winning World War II with the M1 rifle. Cowboys and Indians, every little boy plays Cowboys and Indians or some variation on that game. And so it's just the reality that guns are a part of our society, for better or for worse. For some people, they're just a tool. For other people, they're a mechanism to use in crime. For some people, it's a matter of self-preservation. I mean, pretty much every cop is carrying a gun on his or her hip. So you have to deal with guns in American society, and I look at the issue from the point of view of the business of marketing, manufacturing and marketing guns, and Glock has been preeminent in the last quarter century in the handgun market. And so I tell the story of Glock so that the reader can gain greater insight into how you make money making and selling guns, and what guns mean to the people who buy all. I mean, we have 250 million guns in this country in private hands. Now, that includes both rifles and shotguns and as well as handguns. But that's a lot of guns. And, you know, the effect they have on the economy, the effect they have on crime, those are all vital questions. And so I think the story of Glock gives you insight into all of those questions.
Well, the story of the Glock touches on so many different things. For readers who may not be, or for listeners who may not be familiar, this is as much a story about business and marketing, as you said, than it is about just being a firearm. Give us the brief history. I mean, it was created back in 1982 by Gaston Glock, and he is such a fascinating guy. Talk to
us
about
Glock
this.
Gaston was an obscure engineer in Austria. He ran a radiator factory during the day and had a side business at home where he made products like curtain rods, and in 1980 he learned that his home country's military was looking to replace their World War II era sidearms, and he put up his hand for the contract. People laughed at him. People in the military laughed at him. Here was a guy who had never designed guns, didn't have any particularly distinctive knowledge about guns, and here he was challenging some of the best names in the business, Beretta, Steyr, Sig Sauer. Sometimes starting with a blank piece of paper is an advantage, and it certainly was for Mr. Glock. He knew what he didn't know, and he gathered some of the best handgun experts of the day. He asked these people what would be the criteria, the characteristics for a modern, innovative handgun, they told him. And he produced a weapon that was made of new materials, industrial-strength plastic rather than metal and wood, that was lighter, that was more durable, and that crucially had a larger ammunition capacity. And by innovating in that way, he made a breakthrough. He won that contract in the Austrian army, and then he turned to the richest gun market in the world, namely ours, the United States.
Well, now, it's more than that, because in a short period of time, the Glock has been adopted by the FBI, the DEA, the Customs
right.
Service, Delta Force.
When he arrived here, the first set of customers that he focused on were police departments and law enforcement agencies. And this was a very savvy move on the part of the salespeople who he hired to sell his product in the United States. It was savvy because at that moment in time, in the mid to late 1980s, police departments were particularly receptive to the pitch that they needed a new gun. Crime was increasing in this country. There was more gun violence, much of it fueled by drug trafficking at the time, crack cocaine. And police departments came to the conclusion that the traditional Smith & Wesson revolver that they had used for 75, 80 years was no longer sufficient, didn't have enough firepower. And here came the 17-round Glock, the semi-automatic pistol, and it was all the rage. Police departments across the country traded their Smith & Wessons in for this new plastic Glock firearm. And once that trend began, the civilian gun market paid attention, because many people look to their local police essentially as a model if they are going to choose to buy a handgun themselves. And Glock made tremendous headway in the civilian market as well.
Well, it did, and it really, in 10 years, captured a huge market share. What were some of the characteristics of the Glock that made it preferable to law enforcement? You mentioned the 17-bullet magazine that can fire, but what else? What other characteristics really are attractive?
The basic characteristic of reliability and durability. One of the things that had happened in the 70s and 80s in the American firearm market was quite similar to what happened in the American auto market. American manufacturers had allowed quality to slip. They had allowed innovation to fade, and they were vulnerable to more nimble, more efficient foreign competitors. Think of the appearance and the rise of Toyota, of Honda, of Volkswagen. Those companies were able to succeed in this country, at least in part, because their engineering was better, and they made more durable, more reliable products, and Detroit got caught with its pants down. Much the same way that Smith & Wesson did. Smith & Wesson's products were not as reliable. Some of them malfunctioned right out of the box. And this made Glock's pitch that it had a new, stripped-down, very simple, very few moving parts alternative appealing. And it got Glock in the door. And once it was in the door, it proved to police departments and then later to the larger civilian market that the thing worked. I mean, it wasn't that it was fancy. It wasn't that it was beautiful to look at. It was that it worked when you needed it to work. And it can work when it's a little bit dirty, and it can work if it gets a little wet. And if you perspire on it, it doesn't rust or corrode. These characteristics became very attractive to people who were making a decision, which gun do I want to buy?
Well, the durability and the ease of maintenance certainly are key. One of the things that struck me in reading your book was that it only has 36 parts, and those parts
right.
are interchangeable across different models of Glock.
Yeah. Comparable pistols will sometimes have as many as twice as many or even three times as many parts. That means that you have to be a real expert to gunsmith many pistols. You almost have to be practically an engineer. Well, the Glock, you can take it apart and put it back together really with one instrument, one little pin-like tool, and you can learn to be a certified Glock armorer in one long day of training. That's a huge advantage when you're trying to sell a product. Say to people, if it should happen to break, you can take it apart yourself and put it back together. You don't have to go into a gun store and get someone else to do it. So that was very appealing, too. And again, I think the comparison to the say to the Japanese cars is an apt one. Again, a Toyota is not necessarily going to be the fanciest car. It's just going to break down less often.
Now, that is true. My guest is Paul Barrett. He's author of the book Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. One of the things, talking more about the business now of the Glock, is that the Glock was so much cheaper to produce than the Smith & Wesson, in part because it had fewer parts. Now, a Glock sells for roughly about $600. What are the profit margins?
That's what you pay retail at a Main Street gun store. You can find offers for $499 if you go online. Like any product, if you're a savvy shopper, you can cut a lot of money off. But the profit margins is the key, because Glock has a very efficient manufacturing process. Its profits are very high, and that allows it to sell at a somewhat more reasonable price point than some comparable guns, such as perhaps the Sig Sauer or the Beretta. And it makes it more appealing to a middle-class clientele, which is willing to pay a substantial amount, but maybe not $700 or $800 for a handgun.
Makes sense. My guest is Paul Barrett. So, Paul, the Glock company has had its share of controversy, though. I mean, Glock
Absolutely.
Incorporated's top executive here in the United States was indicted for embezzlement, and his trial begins soon.
He's in jail right now awaiting trial. He's got a trial date next month.
Mr.
Glock himself was the victim of an assassination attempt back in 1999. And the person sitting in prison convicted of having hired the hitman in that case was his own chief financial advisor. So this is a company that has absolutely been racked by internal controversy. And the extraordinary thing is that with all of that turmoil in the management ranks, the company as a commercial enterprise has rolled along and the revenues have kept coming in. It's quite extraordinary. I think many companies with those kinds of problems at the top would kind of stall and fall apart.
But Glock certainly didn't. Well, now, you've actually fired a Glock, haven't you, as part of the research for this book. Describe that experience of squeezing off a few rounds with the pistol.
If you've never done it, it's a very powerful experience. I mean, there's no doubt that, it's quite different. It's not like playing other sports. You can feel the power, and you can even sense the danger of what you're doing, and it makes you very, very self-conscious, very safety-conscious. I have had a lot of instruction from top firearm teachers, and I find it to be a very absorbing avocation, and it's also a lot of fun. Hmm. It's just fun to go from being unable to hit the center of the target to being able to hit it, and it requires tremendous concentration. And I think people who are skeptical of guns probably don't understand just how much fun it is to actually fire a gun at a range. And if they did understand that, they might have more sympathy with people for whom guns are a hobby.
All right, Paul. Well, I'm going to take the other side of that argument. So gun opponents assert that a firearm like the Glock really adds to gun violence in the United States. And all you need to do
There is that argument. Sure.
Yeah. All you need to do is just look at the gun-related deaths. In the United States, per 100,000 people, we have 14.24 gun-related deaths. In Austria, the country where the Glock is manufactured and sold, you only have 3.7 deaths for every 100,000 people. So, do semi-automatic weapons like the Glock lead to higher rates of gun violence?
Opponents of guns certainly make that argument, and I think it is fair to come to the conclusion that we have a higher rate of gun homicide in this country because there are so many guns around. We don't have a higher crime rate overall compared to similar industrialized democracies. Our rates of assault, our rates of break-ins, rape, and so forth, those are quite comparable to other large industrialized countries. The difference is that our crime is more lethal. When someone attacks someone in this country, they're more likely to do it with a gun, and a gun is more effective than a knife or a baseball bat.
True.
So there you have a point that I think is irrefutable. Now, whether that's caused by guns and whether the sale of more guns leads to more violence, then things start to get a little more complicated.
And that's
by that, I want to point out another set of statistics.
Okay.
The number of guns in America has been growing steadily over time. Every year there are millions of guns sold here, and that was true in the 60s, true in the 70s, true in the 80s, 90s, and so forth. And yet crime rates have not gone steadily up. So there's not a direct correlation between the prevalence of guns and crime rates. We had crime increasing very drastically from the 60s all through the 90s, so for 30 years. And during that period, many people came to the conclusion, well, it must be because there's more guns. More guns equals more crime. But then we continued to pump out guns, and people continued to buy guns, and crime started going down in the early 1990s, went down drastically across the 90s, and has continued to decrease through today. So it's now becomes a little more complicated to make a simplistic cause and effect relationship between the number of guns in society and the level of crime. So my approach to all of this is to take it piece by piece, to not jump to very, very broad conclusions, and to stick to conclusions that are solid and you can hang your hat on. And otherwise, for example, in trying to explain the vacillation in crime rates, to be cautious when we really don't have solid answers as to why crime levels go up and down.
A very prudent approach. My guest is Paul Barrett, author of the book Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Paul, what do you want readers to take away from reading your book, Glock?
Well, one of the themes that just carries through almost all the work I do, whether I'm writing about racial relations or I'm writing about comparative religion or, in this case, writing about firearms, is that frequently people's assumptions ought to be subject to reexamination. People, for example, in connection with guns, people who assume that anyone who has a liking for guns has got to be a yahoo or a violent person or someone to be feared. By reading my book, I think you will question that assumption, because in addition to the manufacturers and the marketers of guns, I introduce you to a lot of gun owners, and I try to explain what's appealing about guns and why people find them so alluring. I do that in part by describing my own personal experiences with guns, my learning about shooting and participating in competitions even.
Right.
So that's on the one side. On the other side, I try to show the potential relationships between guns and crime, guns and violence. So the people who are big Second Amendment proponents, and that's fair enough, there is a Second Amendment, it does protect gun rights, will perhaps think twice about whether there are refinements, there are restrictions that are reasonable, so that we can control who owns guns and how they use them.
And we're going to have to leave it there. My guest has been Paul Barrett, author of the book Glock, The Rise of America's Guns. Paul, thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming. We'll talk to you down the road.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.